accepted themselves under the king, but they did not accept themselves under Parliament. Then Parliament made a rule, and that ruling brought about the Boston Tea Party, where some Indians, where they really weren't Indians, it seemed to have been obvious that it was white people, and they came and they dumped all the tea because of the taxes that they went against. Anyway, I don't remember exactly, but Benjamin Franklin did something wrong and he was put on trial. Now, you have to understand, he was for the idea, and he held a lot of Americans back from revolution. He held that we should stick with Britain and that we're better off sticking with Britain. But he was put on trial, and there was a certain prosecutor that everybody came to listen to, because he knew how to tear a person apart. It was like a show, you know, and everybody came to listen to this prosecutor, and now they were going to prosecute Benjamin Franklin, and he could get in jail or death penalty. And he really, for an hour straight, tore Benjamin Franklin apart. He ripped him to pieces. I think it was... the way I read it, I think if I remember an hour, but anyway, okay, and the people were really into it, you know, but it was at that moment, Benjamin Franklin wasn't broken, but it was at that moment that he changed from staying with Britain to joining the revolution, and Benjamin Franklin was a very wise, intelligent person. He knew how to write, he knew how to speak to people. He was the one that brought in other countries, France in particular, to be on the side of the revolutionaries. And because of that, England fought a war. First of all, had to lose the soldiers, and it had cost some money. And they lost the war. They lost the whole United States because of that. Because of why? Because the guy enjoyed, he was a vicious person. He enjoyed tearing the person apart. And I'm sure he also enjoyed the people cheering him on, you see. But that moment of pleasure and his ignorance of speaking to humans, you see, he caused the Revolutionary War. We find this many times, for instance, parents of teachers that do not know how to talk to their children or to their students, and out of ignorance. They don't know. And they just talk to them in a... they turn people away. Kids rebel. Kids run away. Kids do things... I mean, terrible things happen because you're ignorant. So when you speak as a result of ignorance, so out of ignorance, you could cause the Revolutionary War. You could cause wars from ignorance. It's definitely ignorance. Ignorance in the sense that he doesn't realize. He only recognizes that he's causing pain, but he does not always recognize the changing in the mechanism and how the person that's receiving the attack, you see, is thinking and what they're thinking of doing and what they actually can do as a result of this attack. Okay, that's the second thing. In other words, I'm saying, like, for instance, let's say you don't know how to talk to a king. You come in front of a king and you don't know how to talk. It's not only anger. You don't know how to talk to the king. You think you could talk to him like an equal, like a friend, and tease him or joke with him, and you wind out without your head. You know what I mean? Off with the head. I mean, I'm talking about ignorance of how what you say, how it affects others. Ignorance of what you say, how it affects others. It could lead to terrible, terrible catastrophes. But definitely ignorance of how you affect others. It's not only anger but it could be ignorance, how to speak to a person. I mean, you could put your life in danger. You could cause many different harms because you're not aware of how you affect others by just your words. Most people think that words is not equal to an action, and that's why in the chapter that we spoke about in chapter 64, the person that does the evil says, who will see me? Who will see me? They're unafraid, and who will see me? Because it's only words. It's only words. They're not afraid of the words. People might be afraid of actions. The words they're not afraid of. The people that are doing it, which is most people, are not aware that they're doing anything wrong. They do not see the harm, what they're doing either to themselves or to others. Now the cause for all three that we just mentioned, namely the incorrect philosophy, the correct philosophy, but you say it to people that are not ready for it, or you just ignorant in general and you speak about it, then the cause for all this is your emotions. It blinds you. You see, either it's anger, or you feel, without really knowing it, how to speak to a king. You don't recognize the harm of talking, whether it's true or false philosophy, since people don't understand it. If you're not aware of human beings, how they understand, how they think, how they accept things, and therefore, because you're ignorant of that, then no matter what you're going to say, you could destroy people, and you could start these terrible, catastrophic things. Now, we know the difference between Proverbs and Psalms is Proverbs is like for an individual, mostly an individual situation. But however, Psalms is evil, good against evil, good versus evil. That's, if you remember our introduction, it was good versus evil. And this chapter, the way I understand this chapter, he's talking on the national level, not on an individual level. These type of catastrophes that Rashi mentioned, or like Benjamin Franklin, we're talking about, there's many times you harm another person individually. It's not going to come out historical catastrophe every time you talk to somebody. But you could destroy the other person. You could harm yourself because people will be angry with you and they'll cause you harm because you didn't even realize that you started something. So the thing is, but the national catastrophe, that's the Psalms that we're talking about in the Psalms, that will destroy. You could start total revolutions, and you could cause the destruction of nations, whole nations, just by the tongue. Okay? The tongue, most people do not see that they could do anything wrong by talking. People just don't see it. That people could understand, you could explain a person in action. Explain a person that if you give over ideas, even if it's a true idea, but people will misunderstand what you're saying, that's a catastrophe, that's a dangerous thing, and you shouldn't do it. But people don't realize that it's even wrong. That's the problem. People do not realize that it's wrong. That is the problem. Now, if you stop to think about what we just said, okay, and you see the catastrophes, and if you were able to take these ideas that we've been speaking about, and you start seeing clearly how words destroy people, or how it could start whole nations, either to destroy or revolution, you see, don't you shudder? I mean, you have to shudder at what a person is saying. Doesn't he know what he's saying? You know, you have to shudder. At one time, there was the first person that discovered germs. So they say he went crazy. Why? Because he used to see doctors. They used to take care of a sick person and then walk over to deliver a baby. He used to go crazy and scream at them. They didn't understand what they were doing. But he shuddered because he saw the terrible destruction going on here where the people who were doing it were totally ignorant. So therefore, people that are totally ignorant and they do things they don't even realize what they're doing. The person that sees the catastrophe that's happening, he must shudder. He has to, don't you see what you're doing? I mean, like, he wants to scream out, don't you see what you're doing? You see? But the fact is, he definitely shudders. Whether he should say anything, if he understands what words do, and he knows how people react to it, so he'll know whether to say it or not. He will think it through whether to say it or how to say it, that he has to think through. But however, the thing is, he definitely, whether he speaks about it or whether he doesn't speak about it, he will definitely shudder. Now we want to know that people will come to fear and they will declare the work of God and his deeds. And in his deeds they comprehend. I'd like to understand how it comes from this knowledge, how you comprehend the works of God. To answer this, we go to the prophet Habakkuk. In the prophet Habakkuk, he has three chapters. You read through carefully of the first chapter, you will see that he's asking a question against God. And his question is, like this. This is his question. The question is that, see, the world is amoral. I mean, you know, it's just laws of nature. But however, we have to be able to see that there is justice in the world and that there is a system of justice in the physical world. Okay? Now, Habakkuk prophesies about Nebuchadnezzar. But Nebuchadnezzar wasn't Nebuchadnezzar yet. I think he was just born at the time that he prophesied. And when he saw that the man was going to last, his kingdom was going to last for a very long time, I think 40 years or so, he says it's not fair because people will see the success of evil. And when they see the success of evil, they will think it's the gods of the evil person that really has power. And that there is no God. It's just too long. I understand that the Jews need punishment. But the extent that you're doing it is you're taking away their ability, to see justice in the physical world because it's too long. Okay? In chapter 2, God answers him, that no, you will be able to see, and I'll just quote 1 second. Starting in chapter 2, verse 6, shall all of these not take up a parable about him and a metaphor and riddles regarding him? One will say, woe to him who amasses that which is not his. How long can he go on? He burdens himself heavily with thick mud. Will those who would bite you not rise up suddenly? And will those who would cause you to tremble not awaken? You will be plunder for them because you have pillaged many nations. All the remnants of the nations will pillage you. For the blood of men that you spill and the robbery of the land, the city, and all its inhabitants. So what he's saying is that even though it's the time that he's winning the war, an intelligent person could see clearly that he's going to be destroyed, because it is impossible in the intelligence. In other words, what God is answering, true, everybody can't see it, but a person that's a chacham, that's wise, that understands the nature of evil and understands that, sees that evil cannot exist through his studies of Mishlei, through his studies of the Psalms, he sees, and through the study of through different areas of Torah, he will see that it's impossible with his mind. He knows it's impossible, so he will know that the success of the evil is the beginning of his downfall. That is his total. That will be his total destruction. So God answers him that the intelligent person can know it. It's still there. The information is there. If you, but it's not for everybody. For the person that doesn't have this knowledge, he could make a mistake where, you know, success. People live by success, and success is can't argue success. You know, like these type of statements. So therefore, they don't see on the overall picture that he must fail, even though he's successful for a very long time. That's the second chapter of Habakkuk. Now, the third chapter, he goes over the whole history of Israel, each verse taking another area, another time of Israel. He goes through how everything worked, how God protected the Jews and crushed the enemy. And it goes the whole history, you see. He said, then he says, verse 16, says, I heard, and my inner shuddered. Again, this is the idea of shuddered. My lips quivered at the report. Rot came into my bones, and I shuddered in my place, because the time I should have rested will become a day of distress for a people to come up with its troops. For the fig tree blossoms not. There is no fruit on the grapevines. The labor of the olive trees has failed, and the fields do not yield food. The sheep are cut off from the fold, and no cattle are in the stall. He's talking about, there's different commentaries. Some say he's talking about the Romans. You know what I mean? When the Romans took over, some say it's talking about the Messianic Age, before the Messianic, you know, he might be talking about famine. I mean, different. He's might be different types of catastrophes that happened to the Jews. Okay, says you have to shudder at the time that it happened. He says, but still in all, verse 18. But as for me, in Hashem will I rejoice. I will exalt in the God of my salvation. You see? The thing is that first he starts off, this chapter, he starts off with a history and knowledge of how God operates. You see? And he gets a picture of the whole system. If you're looking at a particular act in a particular situation, like when he said he shuddered, if you just looked at that particular situation, when he shuddered, you would say, well, where is God? You say, you could say, well, how could there be a good God that could allow these things? And then you would fail in seeing the truth, you see. But if you look at the total picture of Israel, the whole picture of the nation, that's why he gives an introduction, the history of the nation, and you see God, the way God operates, because you're able to have an overview of the whole system, of the whole history of Judaism and the whole picture. So then, when this catastrophe happens, you realize that's just part of God's system, and you understand the system, and therefore you have to shudder at the catastrophe, but still in all, you still rely on God and you turn to God. It's not a question against God, if you understand the whole system. It is true that knowing it is one thing, and then actually feeling it, where it becomes real to you, that there is no doubt, is another thing. Therefore I say the way to reach this, one of the ways to reach this idea is what we're just saying, where you could see through history where words, just words, mere words, which most people do not hold as any importance, and you could see how total catastrophes come. Or you could see in everyday life how people are destroying others with words, and what catastrophes happen from the words, you see. Then it means that you have the ability to have an overall look, and an overall picture becomes real to you. When the overall picture becomes real to you, you see, then the history of Judaism and how God relates to us and how God deals with us and God's plan for us through the study of Torah and then seeing it in history, you see. And there are commentaries like Maimonides and Nachmanides that even today show how things are part of God's plan, and they're showing different actions, how it might be, by things might be part of God's plan when it's on a national level, you see. So we're interpreting it on an overall picture. When you could have that overall picture, and then you could see God's system on an overall picture, then it'll be totally real to you. But where does it start? It must start simply, not by the overall picture, by just seeing God's way. It must start where it's real to you, and you see when a person opens his mouth, you could see the catastrophes or the possible catastrophes that could happen. Just words become real, then ideas are real, you see, and the ideas of Torah, how God's total system becomes real to you, then you cannot doubt that this world is guided by God. You see it through every area. It becomes real to you, the system, and you actually see it through history. You see it first through Torah, and then you see it through history, and it's a real to you. And that is why you've come to see the greatness of God. Okay, the question is how do we see from seeing how people mess things up with words, how do I see the greatness of God? To be able to see from where somebody tells off Benjamin Franklin, and to see the Revolutionary War as a result of that. And then you start seeing, for instance, there was somebody under President Wilson at the time of the Versailles Treaty, and he saw the treaty was a bad treaty. He says this treaty must lead to a Second World War. It was just written down. It's just words. You know what I mean? And he saw that these words, you have to have a big view and to see the consequences of an idea. The consequence of an idea, just an idea, could bring out terrible consequences. Saying something that you don't know how to represent it could cause terrible catastrophes. When you can have the overall picture like that, then you could see God operating through history, because you have the ability to have an overall view of history. But most people do not have that overall view of history. They might know history, but they don't see the connections insofar as these things. They only see, you know, there was a big battle, you know, here, but they don't see that the Revolutionary War happened when one guy just told off another guy in public. That's all that happened. Nobody sees that type of connection, but that was the beginning of, that's where the Revolutionary War started. The thing is that you do not get this idea from one case. In other words, like for instance, when we want to say a law like a law of physics, a concept in physics, we have to see that it works in all the details and all the factors, so we get a principle that operates. If you see it in one or two cases, well, that's not a principle. It could be, you know, it happens, but it's not necessary. But when you start seeing it in every day of your life in hundreds of cases, then the principle, first of all, you see the principle clearer. In every case that you see in the everyday life becomes clear, and in history it starts to become clearer. and it starts becoming real to you. But it doesn't become, you can't prove it in one or two cases. You have to show that this is a law of nature that does work. And then you start seeing an overall picture of this law of nature on a historical over hundreds of years, you see, that really operate a certain philosophy, how it affected 100 years later, you know what I mean? And how a person insults somebody, how it affects the whole global picture. There are many, many cases that I'm sure you're aware of that you read history and you didn't make this type of connection. But as you go back over history and start reading history and start in everyday life seeing how things connect, when one person says something that connects different events, and you see the connections, then you have the ability to see the connections from the principles of Torah, how you could read history and see these principles operating in the physical world. And that, when you see it operating so clearly, and you see the principles of Torah operating so clearly, you must say, yeah, that's God. There has to be. That couldn't happen without it comes right from the Torah, you see? And so therefore you see the ideas of God operating in the physical world, and then you will be able to see God's justice working in the physical. You will be able to see God's justice working in the physical world, you see? And when you see God's justice working in the physical world, then you know there's a God. I'm sure that if everybody in this class gave examples and we remember back, I'm sure if once we know the principle, we could really see, like in hundreds of places, this principle working, different places in the statements of our sages, and different statements in the commentaries and in the Torah, you'll start seeing a universal picture here. And as you start seeing it, it becomes real to you. You start seeing a system that history is itself a system in way people act and the repercussions of their decisions, whether it's a good decision, you could see good things happening from it, and if it's a bad decision. And in that, you could see good and evil operating in the world, and it's through good and evil that we know God. God must, in the physical world, somehow see good and evil. We must see God relating to us, either how he relates to us through good and evil, to good and evil, okay? So therefore, once you see that, you see that there really is a system, and you see there's a system of good and evil. It's not just haphazard or a chance, and you see God's will operating in the physical world with the help of the commentaries many times, so then you must accept God. But you must see that there is, that it's not, that history is not haphazard, but that there really is a system operating within the laws of nature. Then you can, within the system of history, it is the laws of nature. Then you cannot deny that there's a God working and operating and affecting us in every time, all the times in our life. Okay, we're back on chapter 5, verse 9, okay? And it says, basically what we said is that his prayer is a comparison up until now between evil, which God does not like, and between him who is a chassid. We said a chassid is a person that has gotten his emotions in line with the will of God. Okay? Verse 9 says, God, guide me in your righteousness so that my watchful, because of my watchful enemies, and straighten before me your ways. Now, the question is, what is God's righteousness? What is his guidance? In other words, he wants God to educate him. Okay, why is suddenly an education here? You know what I mean? Right in the middle, he's asking God for an education. I mean, what is the purpose of this education? So verse 9 is saying that King David has a certain slight insecurity, and that is maybe his knowledge is not enough for God to relate to him in this situation to win over against the enemy, to win against the enemy. Or it's possible that maybe he's in doubt, that maybe he, even though it doesn't seem to point to that, but there's always the possibility that maybe he did some sin without realizing it, and so there also it might be, but the terminology in the verse seems to point to, says, guide me in your righteousness and straighten me out in your ways, seems to be a general thing about ideas, that he seems to be more, the verse seems to point to insecurity about his knowledge of God, and therefore maybe God cannot relate to him because he needs more knowledge. So he says, guide me in this situation because of my watchful enemies. By watchful enemies, it means they're always watching for him to fail and to go under, and they're right there to take care of it, to do it. Okay? We're in the middle of the Psalms, chapter, Perikah, Hey, or 5. And what we've covered so far is that he's asking God to protect them against the people that the verbal that people were talking about him, either against him, whether it was Lashon Hara or whether it was ideas to undermine the government. Okay? That was basically the subject of this chapter. And we're up to verse 10. And he says, Kein b'fiu nechona. Now, the last verse, it says, please guide me because of my watchful enemies. It says, who are my watchful enemies? They're watching for fault. They're watching for mistakes. And he says, because they are people that their words are not sincere or not straight. Okay? And kirbam avos, and their innards are treacherous. Okay, in other words, they speak smoothly. You understand? They speak like they want to be friends with David, but really behind the back, beneath that in the heart, is really treachery. They speak smooth. You see? And he says, Keva pasuach geronam, their throat is like an open grave. Okay? There's two commentaries. One says that that because the throat is the way to the inside, just like a grave is the way, you know what I mean, to down to the grave, you see. But some say because just like the grave tick, you know, that's the death that takes you in, so the throat for these type of people would cause death. Through their speaking, it's either death or harm. Death is the ultimate harm. So through their words, they cause harm, and the ultimate harm is actually death. And lashonam yachalikun, and their words are smooth, meaning that that they have all types of plans and ideas. There's ideas that talk. There's two types of talking here. There's one talking that's either in the heart or behind the scenes, where they make plans and they schemes. They have the plans and schemes, you know, to destroy David, right? But however, when they speak to him smoothly. So therefore, he says that these people are very, very dangerous people, because an open enemy you can know. you know. I mean, a person screams at you, a person yells at you, a person is at your borders ready to destroy you, so you know who they are. You know what I mean? But these people are very smooth, and you have to know how to recognize when a person talks one way and he really means harm, and he doesn't really mean what he's saying. Smooth talker, you know what I mean? So that's more difficult to deal with. Verse 11 says, God caused them to be guilty. In other words, condemn them for their... In other words, you condemn them for their sins. And let their schemes fail because of their excessive sins, drive them away. And then he says, Kimaru bachot, they rebelled against you. Okay? There are always two things. There is when a person harms you personally, you see, that we should look away, if at all possible. I mean, you're allowed to protect yourself, but you should not take vengeance like afterwards. After the situation is over, you should overlook it and forget it. But however, when it comes to God, that you cannot overlook, you see, and that's the only situation that you could pray, you see. You pray to God because of these people that are evil. I am righteous. He always makes that comparison between himself, that he is righteous and they are evil. And therefore, since they are evil, you should destroy them because of their evil. Okay? So he says, and they're rebelling against you, and therefore you should remove their schemes and drive them away. That's verse 11. And verse 12 says, and if you do this, then all the people that trust in you will be happy, they'll sing forever, and you will cover them, or like a ceiling, like a roof. It will protect you and cover them. And they'll be happy with you, all that love your name. Okay? Because you have blessed the righteous God, and like a shield, it's your will that you should be a shield and surround the righteous and protect the righteous. Okay? So what he's saying here in the last few verses, there are, in other words, when the Russia fails, when the wicked person fails, there are two things. There's certain people that can't relate to ideas. And since they can't relate to the ideas, they have to see physically that the wicked fail. So when they see the wicked fail, then they feel more secure. However, the righteous, they're happy when they see the system is working, that the wicked fail. They relate to the system, and because they see that the system is working, therefore they'll be happy and contented, and they'll sing songs because they see the system is working, that the wicked are destroyed, and so therefore they will be happy. And we're going to take a side point here, okay, something separate. What we'd like to discuss is success. There's two types of success and failure. There's one which is out of your hands. So that's like a drunk driver drives on the sidewalk. I mean, you know, you have it's out of your hands. That you have to pray to God to help you in those situations, okay? The success that is in your hands is the success in your decision-making. That's the only success you have where you make decisions. So therefore, it would be good to know how to make decisions. There are three aspects to making decisions. And the first one that we have to know is that you could either make a decision rationally or you could make it emotionally. Okay? Now the question is, what are you going to use to determine whether the rational or the emotional way is better? If you use rationale, so you come out with a rational answer. If you use emotions, you'll come out with an emotional answer. So what is the method of deciding whether to use a rational decision or an emotional decision? The first possibility is that look at historically which ones are more successful. Is that correct? Yeah. But when you look at historically, you are gathering information and analyzing the results, right? So that's your mind doing it. Is that correct?
Right.
So therefore, your mind is making the decision already, not the emotion. So the emotions don't have a chance. You would make an emotional decision. You would just say, well, this feels right to me, and that's it. Yeah, once you do analysis, that's logical. So the question is, how do you prove whether to make emotional decisions or rational decisions? Because once you use one of them, then you can't prove it. Now, how are you going to go to prove it without one or the other? If I want to make a decision emotionally, I would just do based on my feelings, how I feel right now. In other words, I'm driving my car and I feel like falling asleep. I'm tired. Made me drowsy, so I go to sleep. That would be an emotional decision. And maybe that's a better decision. All right, the question is maybe we should evaluate the results. See, recognize the results. Okay? So the answer is we can't accept that either, because when you're analyzing the results, you're using the mind to analyze the results. So, or you feel the results are good. It's a good result. So again, you're using either your mind or your emotions to evaluate the results. So you can't look at the results either.
It's kind of reasonable.
Okay, the answer is that whenever you have an emotion, like everybody was giving examples here, and you saw that every decision, every emotional decision could not get out of a logical, that you have to use logic in it. Somehow, there's some type of logic. In other words, one of the examples was, let's say you're driving a car and you have a desire to put your hands in your pocket, right? That's an emotional decision. But then there's a fear of death. But the only way you got to the fear of death is you know that if you put your hands in your pocket, so then the car's going to get out of control and you could die. So the fear of death comes in, right? Well, that's a logical thing, you see? So even the emotion of fear of death needs logic to come to that conclusion. It's not pure emotion. There is nothing that is pure emotion. I mean, cigarettes. Cigarettes is not a natural instinct. It's a learned thing. You see people doing it, so you learn it. Learning is the idea. So in other words, I see you doing something that causes me to awaken a desire. I'd like to do that thing. There's a certain amount of steps in the decision.
What about something like...
And the question is let's say a mother runs out instinctively to save a child. That instinctual desire to save a child, that's an instinctual thing. But, however, to go out and run and save the child, that's based on experience prior that the only way you could save a child, that death comes from a truck hitting you, and you know that from before, and you have to associate that to now, and it's from knowledge, but you act on your instinct based on that knowledge. It's very, very, it's practically impossible past the age of 3-4 months to distinguish between logic and emotion. You can't separate. That was the big problem. How are you going to separate between the two? You see? So therefore, we say that we see in every case to carry out your emotions, you need logic. It is impossible to do anything without logic. So the answer is that we would like to see if you could do anything without logic, then there's at least a possibility. But once you pass the age of 3-4 months, like for instance, if you say table is an idea. It's an idea already. If I say this, if I'm pointing to the table and I say this, that's like the caveman. That's the only thing they could do.
they said us, because they didn't have a developed mind. But once you have a developed mind, you automatically are thinking. Table is an idea, you see. So once you have that idea, so therefore it is impossible to come to any conclusion without logic. And even emotions are dependent on logic. So therefore, since it's totally dependent on logic, so therefore I must say logic must be the better thing. The question is a logical decision to start smoking? No. There is a desire, but it's based on knowledge that other people enjoy smoking and that it could be pleasurable. Therefore, that causes me to want it. And then I have to reach out. I must direct my mind to reach out for the cigarette, put it in my mouth, light a match. There is a certain order that I must have in mind to get that cigarette. If I don't do these acts, it's equal to driving a car. If I decide to take my hands off the wheel, I could. I could take my hands off the wheel, but that's an emotional decision. Logic will tell me not to do that. You have to say that you can't do anything without logic. Even emotions you can't carry out without logic, like we were saying about the primitive tribes. They say if you violate this taboo, you'll get a certain consequence. Now, that's a logical process. It's just the question is scientifically whether taboos really cause this consequence. That's something else. But they are using a certain method of thought. So to carry out their it's all based on emotions, all their ideas of taboo. But however, to carry it out, they're using a certain method of logic. So I see that you can't do anything without thought. And since you can't do anything without thought, thought must be the primary thing. Now, the question is like this. We came to the conclusion that that since the emotions are dependent on logic, that therefore we said that logic is better. So the question is, no, I can't come to that conclusion. I can only come to the conclusion that emotions are dependent on logic. But that doesn't mean that the logic is better. Okay, that is the question. All right, let's try this answer. And that is that, yeah, let's say we come to the conclusion that logic is primary to emotions, and you cannot make any decision without logic. Is that correct?
I'll agree with that.
Okay. So therefore, we will retract that it's better, but we'll say that you cannot make any emotional decision without logic. Okay. So therefore, when the primitive tribe says a certain taboo brings to certain consequences, if you don't follow the taboo, right? So they're using logic, okay? Now, since logic is primary, then shouldn't I analyze whether taboo would bring about that result? Because since we proved that logic is primary, so therefore shouldn't logic also be part of the very basis of that the taboo is also not true. Taboo will not bring about such consequences. Let's say we could prove it. It's only in your mind, but it's not true. So therefore, it's not that it's better, but you have no choice. That's the only thing you could do is make a decision based on logic. What we have then so far is that since logic must be basic to every emotional decision, therefore you should use logic to analyze the emotion itself, because that's primary to every emotional decision. Now, once I could use logic, then I could analyze the results of emotional actions and logical actions, and once I analyze that in a logical way, I'll come to that logical conclusions will have the more beneficial effect than just making an emotional decision. That's not then it's not a problem anymore. Once I accept the emotions, that's not a problem. Now, the question is it possible for a human being to separate between, in other words, we're saying that the human being should separate between his emotions and his logic and make every decision logically. The question is it possible for a human being to separate between his logic and emotions? Is that correct? There are two types of emotions. There's emotions, which is decision-making, and there's the emotions as a result. Okay? In other words, whether I should have ice cream, that's a decision. When I have the ice cream, then I feel pleasure. I feel enjoyment. We are not talking about the emotion that is based on the result. I mean, that we're not against at all. That's a natural thing, and we're not against before that. In other words, we're not against being emotional. You're right. That's a human being. What we are against is making decisions based on your emotions. In other words, let's say I'm greedy, I'm a spendthrift, I'm stingy. Is those three rational ways of making decisions about money, or is there a better way to make decisions about money? You see? Now that I could separate, and after I think it through, I could reach a point where I only make decisions about money based on logic. Now, it's true, like Benji wanted to say, that the emotion could affect my thinking process, but the basic foundation of my thought is based on, I could change and start thinking about money through training only in a totally logical way, and I will not make any decisions based on stingy, greedy, or spendthrift. The question is about ice cream, okay? Now, I have a desire for ice cream. That's an emotional desire. Now, the question is, if I have diabetes, should I have ice cream? The answer is no. I shouldn't give in to that desire.
That's what I asked.
I'm not saying that you remove emotional desires. I mean, you want to get married. That's an emotional desire. But, however, we have proven that before you carry out any emotional desire, you should logically think about it. I'm not saying that, in other words, like this, I have an emotional desire to be stingy. That's an emotional desire. Should I give in to it? So I know, I think about it. Now, ice cream is another emotional desire. Now, if I have diabetes, I shouldn't have any of it. If I don't have diabetes, then maybe a certain quantity is okay, and a certain quantity is not okay. So I'll make a decision based on quantity. So the thing is that even, I'm not saying you don't have emotions, but emotions should never make the decision to carry out your emotions. Whether you should carry out your emotions should be based on your logical decision. In other words, you have to be careful. In other words, like this, let's say I'm greedy. Now, then I would plan on how to make a lot of money. I would go out, I'd be greedy, then my mind would be at the service of the emotion, and then I would carry out the logic from there. But however, whether I should be greedy or not, that is a different question. That also should be analyzed. You see? That's what we're saying now. Since you must think out things logically, everything must be logical, so therefore the very question of greed itself, should I be greedy, should be also based on the logical decision. All right. In other words, what we're saying, any decision to be successful, we see needs logic. Okay? And therefore, we say to be successful, even to carry out an emotion, you must be logical to carry out that emotion to be successful and carry out that emotion. So we say that therefore logic must be the deciding factor to be able to be successful in all your decision making. All right, we're going back to the question of that. What the original question was that if the if you use, in other words, how do you make a decision? There's only logic or emotion, okay? So if you use logic, then you come to that conclusion. If you use emotions, you come to that conclusion.
Question, said you can't do that.
What we're answering is we notice that whenever you make an emotional decision, there must be logic used to be successful about that emotion. And that in itself, I realize, is logic. In other words, what I'm saying here is logic, but there's no way out because emotions don't think. In other words, the very question itself is logical. You cannot make an investigation based on your emotions. It's an impossibility. You would have to be a total... you can't have a brain. Nothing. The brain has to be taken out. That's the only way it's possible. You can't talk. You can't have a conversation without thought. You see, it's impossible to operate without thought. The very question is based on thought. The analysis is based on thought. Everything. So every time when you want to do anything, you must use logic. There is no way out. So therefore, we say it must be that therefore, since everything is logic, so then I should analyze everything by logic. In other words, not only should I carry out my greed with logic, but I should also question whether greed itself is good. You see? So therefore, what we're saying is that there is absolutely no way out. In other words, you see that there's no way out. You have to be logical. There's no way out. Because you can't even carry out an emotion without logic. In other words, the question itself is assuming that you could only get to this through logic. So therefore, you see, you can't get out of logic. I would just like to clarify from last week. Okay, what we said, the question originally was... how to make a correct decision? What's the best way of making a decision with your emotions and your logic? Basically, what we said, that the very question is logical. The emotions would never ask such a question. So what we're basically, we're not saying whether it's better to do with logic or emotion. We're saying the investigation can only be with logic. You have no choice. You must make, the investigation must be with logic. Because you have no choice. That's the only thing you have. Okay? In other words, we're saying, we're not giving any value judgment. We're only saying that the only way to make to make the investigation is only through logic. You do not have any other tools in the human being. There is no other tool to do an investigation except with the mind. If you don't do it with the mind, with logic, then you can't do an investigation. Emotions only have a certain feeling, a certain sense. That's it, but they can't do an investigation. The very question is a logical question. In other words, you have no choice, but any investigation that you want to do can only be with the mind. It's not a question, could you do it with emotions, or should you do it with emotions, or should you do it with logic? The question is, you can't answer that question and say I should do it with emotions. That's impossible. The only tool that you have for investigation is through logic and through the mind. Better clarify that. You can make a decision with your emotions, but you can't investigate with your emotions. Okay? All right, so now we come to the point where we want to define what... Then now we have to use our mind to prove rationally which is the best way of living. According to our mind, according to our emotions. Okay? Now, I would like to give an example by power. Okay? how power works. Okay. Now, the thing is that I'd like to define a term, and that term is addiction, okay? We usually are aware of physical addictions, like smoking, okay? Smoking is you must have the cigarette, and if you don't, you just can't live without it. I mean, it would affect your whole way of making decisions. It would just take over. I mean, when it comes to drugs, there are people that totally ruin their lives because they were drawn to drugs, okay? Now, we have, now some of these addictions that I just mentioned, some of them are physical, there's a psychological part, but however, there are psychological addictions. One of them is power, okay? Power means is that I must control others, and I want to be in control of others. Everybody should be afraid of me, and I should have control over them. That's power, basically. While there's another thing called fear. In other words, there's a rational fear, like you look two ways when you cross the street. That's rational. It's based on, but then there's the irrational fear, okay? And the success of the person that's in power is usually based on the, usually, I can't say 100%, based on the fear or complacency of the people that he wants to control. They just, like, for instance, when Hitler went into France, I mean, nobody said anything. Nobody said a word. They just backed off. So when they backed off there, he went to the next place. He went to Czechoslovakia. So at some point, they saw that nothing was enough. That's when war happened, you see. So the thing is, when you have a fear of going to war, that is when the that is when the addiction of power wins. Okay? Because your fear puts you at a disadvantage. Okay? Now what happens is at a certain point you realize that he wants everything. He wants to make you a slave. You know what I mean? And that suddenly you lose that fear. Simultaneously that you're losing the fear, in most cases, again, I'm not saying all cases, in most cases, what happens is the addiction of power has become very strong. The more successful he is, the more the addiction grows, which means as he's more addicted, then he has he's working with less rationale. So he's making more mistakes than he would have when he first started out. When he first started out, he might be a little cautious because he doesn't feel secure. He's working on it. He's building. Now, when he sees people back off, you know, like a bully, people back off, so that encourages the bully to go further. When he goes further, so he feels more and more secure. But at a certain point, the people that are afraid of him suddenly work out a plan to protect themselves while he has reached a point where he's totally addicted and he makes a foolish mistake. You see? So the thing is you see that through this is that the power of emotions are very addictive. And therefore it's during that addiction where you cannot think straight. You see, because it's equal to an addiction, and you cannot think straight, so therefore that's what makes you fail. And what happens is the more you're successful, the more you're addicted, the more you're addicted, the more mistakes you make, until even people that are not as strong as you, like in Rome, I mean, it was barbarians that just took over the Rome, you see. Once your addiction is so powerful, then you must lose. And that is every nation you see, as they became, in other words, if power was really successful, then there should have been one powerful nation, and basically it should have been in power all the time. But you see through history that there have been many nations that had the power, and somehow they lost it. Why did they lose it? The answer is because they became corrupt, and their corruption causes addiction, and their addiction causes their failure. So therefore, we see that the if you look at the life, if you look at the life of these type of addictions, in the area of their addictions, they will fail. Where they're blinded to reality in that area, that's where they will fail. The question is, how should you deal rationally in all these situations? The answer is that you should always work on the practical. Always work out what's the practical in this particular situation. Like we said about money, you could be stingy, you could be greedy, you could be a spendthrift. All those are emotions that will not allow you to look at the reality. The stingy person will continue saving. He could have millions of dollars, but he can't spend. The greedy person could have millions upon millions of dollars. He can't stop working. The spendthrift could be totally broke, and he can't stop spending. They're all going to fail. The intelligent person looks at his needs, and he puts a dollar amount on it. He doesn't make it infinite, like constantly just doing one way or the other. But however, he puts dollar amounts on what his needs are and at what point, what needs he should, if he doesn't have enough money, then he has to evaluate what needs he has to take care of and what needs he should push off. And he has to evaluate how much money should he put away for emergencies, how much money should he put away in case he can't work or he gets too old to work. All these things have to be worked out, and there should be a dollar amount on it. What I'm saying is that any emotion that makes decisions and it becomes addictive, that decision, that emotion becomes addictive in your decision making, that even if it's not addictive, but it could be harmful, but at least if it's not addictive, it's easier to deal with. But if it's addictive, then you cannot think clearly about it. Any emotion, depending on the human being, what his personality is, can become addictive. These are only the, what I gave was only examples, but it could be any emotion. A little clarification about fear. Fear is an addiction, and sometimes, like for instance, if you have like a ghetto mentality or a slave mentality, then no matter what, how bad it is, usually you cannot pick your head up because you cannot stand up to the people that are oppressing you. But however, if you are not, if you do not have a ghetto mentality, but just your fear, or you let your fear take over, then when you see that the person will not quit, no matter how much you give him, he doesn't back off, at a certain point you say, look, it doesn't matter if I die, I might as well fight for my freedom, you see? So the thing is, I mean, the details of examples are probably infinite in all the different, you know, cases, all different emotions. But however, I'm just giving these different situations so that you could see clearly an addiction means that it blinds you to reality and you must continue acting in the same way even though you're constantly failing. It doesn't make a difference. You can't help yourself. Even if it's destroying you, you can't help yourself. In other words, addicted to do well is also a problem because there are people that want to do well and they're driven until they hurt themselves physically and psychologically, and it has to be worked out exactly how much you work you should put in. How much your abilities are, and how much you have to evaluate yourself in particular, and you can't measure yourself in relationship to others. You must evaluate your own abilities and how far you could go, and where either physically or emotionally you're going to break down. So that could also be a harm. We're not saying that you should not give in to emotional desires. You can give in to emotional desires, but the decision whether you should give in to an emotional desire should be based on logically thinking it out. Let's say you want ice cream. Well, if you're diabetic, I think logically you shouldn't do it. You see? But if you're not, and you have a scoop of ice cream, it's not a catastrophe. I mean, enjoy it. You understand? All I'm saying is that decisions shouldn't be made emotionally. Doesn't mean you should not give in to emotional desires, but when you should or when you shouldn't should be decided with the mind. Shouldn't take over your decision-making process.
Yes, then
the question is, what about love of God? That's an emotion. The answer is that emotions as a result is not, we're not against emotions as a result. Let's say, for instance, I want to have ice cream. And logically, I could have ice cream. So when I eat the ice cream, I'm enjoying it. That enjoyment, as a result, we're not against. That you enjoy something. In other words, you become attached to God. But the decision in what direction you should go, in what direction you should be guided, that should be the your mind should direct you.
So then we're not.
Even when you're driven by your love of God, you still must be very careful to make sure it doesn't cause you to make a mistake. We don't accept fanaticism. So therefore, in the law, you still have to make decisions intellectually. You see, it might drive you to, the emotion will help you in different ways. It'll benefit you. But insofar as our discussion, the decision making should always be thought out according to the mind.
Are you saying that?
Now, the question is why did God make the emotions? The answer is he wanted a being to have free will. The only way you could have free will is if you have two ways of making decisions, one correct and one incorrect, and you have to find the correct way. You know, what's the best way? You have to work it out to find the best way, like we're doing here, how to make your decisions and on what basis you should make your decisions. We are only talking about success. We're not talking about happiness. Happiness is impossible for anybody that has an addiction. It's impossible for them to be happy. Happiness is out. But however, our discussion is only dealing with success and failure. That's all we're trying to show, is success and failure. It has nothing to do with happiness. Therefore, the best possible life is the life of knowledge and ideas, and then with those ideas, with your mind and with the trained mind, to investigate the emotions and to straighten out those emotions or deal with those emotions that are addicted, that would be the best life. In other words, an attachment to learning, drawn to learning, a love of learning if possible, but definitely practically to be involved in learning. And two, part of the investigation for success is to investigate the addictions that cause you to fail. Because if you don't investigate those addictions and you don't deal with it, then even an intelligent person will fail. Okay? Okay, we're going to start Perek Vav again and review very quickly. The first verse tells us the musical instrument that is used with this song. Okay? Then verse 2 says that he says to God, he says, I understand that I have to have punishment. I deserve punishment. But, however, the extreme that you're giving me does not allow me to operate and to tshuva and repent. Now he describes the extent of the problem. He says, have mercy on me, God, because I'm broken, okay? And please heal me because I'm frightened, okay? And then he says, my soul, that he's talking about like his physical condition. And then in the verse 4 he says, and my soul is extremely frightened. And you, God, how much longer are you going to extend this pain that I'm receiving to this extent? In other words, he understands punishment, but the problem is the extent he's not able to do tshuva. Then he says, accept me, God, return to me, God, and rescue my soul, and help me because of your kindness. So he says, because of your kindness means that I recognize that I don't deserve that you should deal with me and to heal me. But however, because you're kind, so if you could please help me out. And then the next verse says, because he says, in death you cannot remember God, you can't mention God. In the grave, who acknowledges you? And the big question here is that, I mean, Olam Haba, in the world to come, I mean, we'll relate to God. Okay? Now, all the commentaries deal with this problem. I think the best answer is that...
So what was the verse?
The verse says that in death you do not remember God. And in the grave you do not acknowledge God. Okay? The question is, after death, that's when the body separates from the soul. And then the soul could relate directly to God. So why is he saying this? He also says this in hollow. Same, not the exact words, but the same type of thing.
There you go.
Right. So the answer is that what level of Olam Haba that you get is decided here. So development is here. In other words, how much you develop here, that's where you stand. So there's different, in other words, in Olam Haba, there's different levels in the world to come. So therefore, your development is here. And so therefore, he says, there is no more development there. There's only development here. Okay. So what he's saying, King David is saying, is please help me so that I could concentrate in either through repentance or through learning and through development to be able to continue my learning. Because in the world to come, there is no more development. At what level I reach is only right here. Okay? Verse 7. He says, I am weakened by my size, and I am drenched all night. And my bed is drenched at night, and my tears soak my couch. That's an unbelievable description. I mean, it's a little exaggeration, but the fact is that you see that many times we think that a righteous person has no problems. Not that a righteous person doesn't have any problems, is that Torah teaches him how to deal with it, and two, how he relates to God during this situation. And he continues, he says, this is also an exaggeration. He says, my eyes are dimmed from anger. I've become aged because of my tormentors. Okay? Now, up until here, he seems to have been sick. Okay? Now, suddenly, he switches to people that are his enemies. Okay? And the thing is that when King David was sick, so then the people that were against him were very happy of his sickness, and they felt that it was all over, was done with. You know, David was out. And so they were very, very happy for him. And this tormented him. Okay? And so he says to God, he says, turn away from me all these sinners, all these people that do sins. They will be turned away, I'm sorry. These people will be turned away. Either he's talking about in the future, in the past, they're not sure, the commentaries. Either it's afterwards, he says they were turned away, or he says that he knows for sure they will be turned away because God has heard my cry. And then he says, God, listen to my prayers. And he says, accept my prayers, and they will be embarrassed and very frightened, all my enemies, and they will return to me and be embarrassed in an instant once they see that I'm cured, and they'll recognize that I am accepted by God. So then they'll be ashamed. I'm sorry. Let me start this over. Okay. There are two value systems. One is a relative value system. That means that my value system is based on others. Like, for instance, competition. It evaluates me if I win a game. Or if I lose a game, that's a different evaluation. Jealousy, if somebody has something that that and I don't have it, so that evaluates me. If something goes wrong, so it seems like life is terrible. You see? So the thing is, it's always in relationship with people. Then there is an objective relationship, and that is in a relationship to God. And the value system that you evaluate is based on your knowledge of God and God's objective system. So here, when you read through the chapter, it seems to be that that he's worried about what people think of him. But if you read through all of the Psalms, you will see that in general, he always explains in different chapters different points of what his value system is. Okay? Like, for instance, here, he turns to God for help. In other words, the only way out is not by his physical strength, not by his money, not by his power, not by any of these things, but he turns totally to God. Then, in other words, and then when he's upset about the people that, when he's upset about the people that, that he's so angry because they enjoy the fact that he has failed, that means that they have an incorrect view of God. In other words, of course, if they had the correct view of God, they would see that he is just, that King David is just, and he deserves not punishment but reward, and he should be protected by God. And therefore, they have a wrong view of God and God's reality because they're misunderstanding. Because when you look down on the tzaddik, on the righteous person that relates to God, that means you have a wrong view of God because they're living the correct life. And if you turn against them, so that means you have an incorrect view. So he feels bad that because of this sickness, a bad view of God has come about, and he's very upset about that. And therefore, he says to God, please turn away all the people, you know, all these sinners, and listen to my voice, and listen to my prayers. He says, and he's secure in the fact that they will be embarrassed, they will be ashamed, and then they'll come crawling back to him when they recognize that God has really just punished him for the moment, but have really accepted him. In other words, there's two steps here. One step is that he turns to God and says, please help me so that I could think straight. And then two, please help me so that the people shouldn't have a wrong view of justice and they think that you are punishing me because you're saying that that's it, I don't want to have anything to do with you, and they're happy about my destruction. They have a misunderstanding of how you operate. They have a wrong view of the way God is relating to King David. But I think he's angry. The question is, what is he angry with? What is King David? Why is he so angry with these people? The answer is because they are turning against justice and they're turning against, in other words, a person has to have feelings about his value system. A human being is emotional, okay? And he must be emotional about his value system, okay? Now, King David is involved in this value system, which he knows to be true, and he knows that he has a relationship to God. So he gets very, very upset when he sees people that are evil and that they are happy with his downfall, not because, see, the way we would feel about it is, who is he to think, you know, like my ego would be hurt. By King David, it's not his ego that's hurt, but it's his philosophy of life that he bothers with him, that these people and they're, I guess they're talking about it, they're getting others to also, you know, have this wrong view of God and the way he relates to people. So they have an incorrect view, and it's his value system, and he's bothered by the people that don't have that value system. They have an incorrect view of God.
Sure.
The same as, if you know the story of Elisha the prophet, when he came in the presence of Ahab's son, who was a very wicked person, he was so upset that when he wanted prophecy, he had to get somebody to play music for him to calm him down so that he could get prophecy. You understand? That's based not on an ego thing. By us, anger is based on an ego thing. But by them, anger was based on their value system, and their value system was the system of Torah. Okay? And the question is, what is King David's sin in this psalm that he's talking about? Commentaries don't seem to say what sin it is, and some even hold that he wasn't writing it for himself, but he was writing it for the future, for Israel. When they would be in trouble, they would have this psalm to be able to say for themselves, if they understood clearly what the idea of the psalm is. The thing is that you have to understand that there is a part of us that we're not aware of, that we're all the source of all our relationships, and our whole value system starts from in the emotions. Okay? Now the thing is that philosophically, we could have learned this chapter, and we could see with our minds, we could have the value system philosophically of what King David is talking about. But that does not mean that our emotions are in line with these ideas. Okay? So therefore, the review of these ideas throughout the Psalms is to help get our emotions, which take years and a lot of patience and a lot of work, to get our emotions in line with the philosophy and the value system that King David is advocating in the Psalms. Right. The question is David's emotions and that he's expressing here, okay? And how it works, okay? The thing is that we hold that no decisions should be made totally on emotions. Emotions should be a result. In other words, like this. Let's say I desire ice cream. Whether I should have it, well, if I have diabetes, I shouldn't have it. And if I don't have diabetes, I should make sure that is a certain quantity, which is no good. Otherwise, if I have ice cream once or twice a week, I can't. And I don't have any other sugar, I can't imagine that's too much any harm at all. You see. So the thing is that. But when I eat the ice cream, I feel good. I have a good feeling. Now, once I make the decision to have ice cream, that should be made by the mind whether I should have it, and evaluate how much I could have, how much I should have, you know, and then, but once I decide to have it, then I could enjoy it, okay? Now, the thing is that, so if emotions are results, we have to understand David's value system. See, our emotions are based on jealousy, competition, vengeance, anger, ego. Our anger is based on these type of things. And even if you have the value system logically of King David, emotionally when you get angry, it's the old emotions. That has to, can't change it just by, with the mind. It takes the mind to do it, but one time that you know the idea, that doesn't make it, that doesn't affect the emotions. It takes a long time. Okay? So So therefore, when David is expressing these emotions, he's expressing his value system. Okay? And his value system is learning, the study of Torah, and getting close to God, and relating to God. That's one thing that's very important. And two, to make sure that the idea, the true ideas of God, come into the world, and not false ideas come into the world. Okay? So the true ideas, so the first part of the prayer, he asks God to help him to be involved in the world of learning. Should have a clear head to learn. The second half he's saying is that please make sure, help me out, and should make me healthy so that these people should not have a wrong value system and they're learning from my situation, they are learning the incorrect view. Okay? So these emotions are a result of his value system. Okay? There are certain religions that their desire is to awaken emotion and to relate emotionally to God. They have to, the way they do that is through dance, song, excitement, all different types of things which awaken the emotion, and that they want to relate to God in a totally emotional manner, which is different than the way Torah views it. And so therefore, that is the difference. In other words, what you're describing is religious emotions that the desire is to relate to God through emotions, not through intellect. What we're describing here is based on the intellect, and based on the intellect of your value system changes, not only in your mind but in your emotions, then how you're affected. You're still affected. You're a human being. You have emotions. You are still affected, but then you are affected by that value system. The religious, what we're talking about is the religious emotion. The religious emotion has two mistakes in it. One is the religious emotion tells you who God is, and two, the religious emotion tells you how to relate that to that God. In Torah, we hold that the religious emotion should only tell you one thing, to learn Torah, and through Torah you should find out who God is, and through Torah you should learn how to relate to God. But the religious emotion should not tell you more than that. But by other religions, the religious emotion tells them who God is. In other words, all the different religions have different physical gods or the way they look at God. And they also, their religious emotion, depending how it comes out, they have different rituals and different things which they do based on their religious emotion. We hold everything must come from knowledge of Torah. But the religious emotion tells you to turn to Torah. That's why we should use our religious emotion, is to get us to be involved in Torah. The last point is the Radak makes commentary like this, and he says, any man that prays with this psalm, he says he's certain that God will listen to his prayer,